North West Arkansas is in a housing affordability crisis, and the solutions are hard to find. So, what can we do about it? This is the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette's podcast. I'm Stacy Ryburn. I'm a reporter for the newspaper covering Fayetteville. And in this instance, I'm covering a few solutions to how we can alleviate our housing affordability woes. I'm going to be talking today with Duke McLarty. He's the director of the Workforce Housing Center of the Northwest Arkansas Council. And we are going to talk about three specific ways that potentially the region could use some resources to alleviate some of the things that we are feeling with the housing crunch. We'll get into what those solutions are specifically, but first I want to introduce Duke. If you could just tell everyone that's listening who you are and a little bit about what the Workforce Housing Center does in Northwest Arkansas.
Sure. Thank you for that, Stacy. Really happy to be joined or to join you today, excuse me, and talk housing. Always an exciting topic, and one that even I understand, my work is focused on the housing work. So obviously my conversations are going to be focused on housing, those that I'm having out in the community. But I hear from friends and family and other people I talk to that housing is coming up just in every conversation in Northwest Arkansas, and excited to talk about it with you today. So just a little bit about our organization. The Workforce Housing Center is a new work stream under the Northwest Arkansas Council's guidance and kind of under their umbrella organization. And historically, the council has focused on quality of life issues, infrastructure issues. It was instrumental in getting the airport built years ago, but issues that impact the entire region. And as our region's population growth has continued to surge, housing affordability and housing for our workforce is becoming one of these quality of life issues as our workforce is being really forced to long commutes, to homes that are come with a significant distance between their home and their distance for no other reason other than that's what they can afford. So my organization is focused on that issue, helping bring some level of affordability back to kind of our central business core in our region. And these three issues that you've highlighted today or issues or solutions, I should say, are certainly areas of our focus. And two of them in particular, the trust fund and the public-private partnership piece, are areas that we have not introduced in our region. And I think need to be certainly on the table and up for consideration as our region continues to sort through how to get ahead of this housing shortfall.
So let's talk about those solutions a little bit. When I started this story, it started off as just an epic novel of, and so I decided that I really need to focus on a few things that we really actually could do here in Northwest Arkansas. And the way I broke it down was our readers will see this coming weekend for the long holiday. The first one is about zoning and the different ways that we can use that as a tool to affect housing affordability. The second one is the establishment of a housing trust fund. And the third one deals with public-private partnerships. And there are a lot of different ways that you could use each of these tools to affect housing affordability. But let's start with zoning. I think zoning is probably the one that people are probably most familiar with, just because if you ever go to any city council meeting of any kind or planning commission, there are often, at least in Fayetteville anyway, deep detailed conversations about zoning proposals in and around someone's neighborhood. So Duke, if you could just tell us a little bit about how you feel that zoning could play a role in affecting affordable housing. The people I've talked to have said perhaps we get a little too granular with zoning. Most cities in Northwest Arkansas anyway have their zoning broken down, single family one, single family two, single family three, single family four, up until 8 to 12, 24 to 48, and it goes up and up. And there's some talk about maybe we could consolidate some zones and just have like a low to moderate residential zone. We could have a moderate to high residential zone. There's a different ways that you could play with zoning to encourage more density and in theory some more affordability. So what are some of the ways you think zoning could play a role in this issue?
I think there are some, you know, more immediate actions our cities could take with their existing zoning code, and then I think there are some longer term goals that they should think about and consider that would shift the current structure and kind of break them out of what in most instances in our region is a use-based zoning code. So that means a property in a certain zone can only be used for certain uses. You know, you mentioned single family, R2, R4, R24. Those are all residential uses. So huge areas or of our region are designated for residential. Others are for commercial, industrial, agricultural. And longer term, I think our municipalities need to think about shifting away from that and not dictating the use of the property, but dictating the form and shape of the buildings within that zoning designation. And this is what is often called a form-based code. Some larger cities in our country have moved to a form-based code. Springdale has introduced one for their downtown. Rogers has introduced some form-based code elements in their city. So it's not unfamiliar in our region, but it hasn't been deployed at mass. And I think long term that's where our cities should focus. Short term, I think within their existing zoning codes and designations, they should open up the allowed uses. So, you know, allow for residential development to happen in more commercially zoned areas. As a region, 22% of our land is zoned exclusively for commercial uses. So if you wanted to put some apartments, you know, over what would be a strip mall, and have a mixed use development, you couldn't do it without going through a special process with that municipality. Ideally, that percentage that's zoned exclusively for commercial activity should be in the 4 to 6% range. And again, we're at 22% of our region zoning is exclusively for that. So, you know, opening that up would allow for residential development to be included along some of our primary corridors. So think of our east-west byways, you know, as they traverse our region. Think of our north-south state highways, where as you drive those, you know, you pass a lot of strip malls, you pass you know, car lots, you pass all these businesses, but there's no residential housing included in those. So I think some low-hanging fruit would be to allow residential building of a certain density. The cities could designate, you know, how dense they want those developments, but to be included there. And beyond just working within and expanding the uses of the zoning code, this also fully utilizes our existing infrastructure and doesn't require our cities and our municipalities and our developers to incur the expense to continue to lay more and more infrastructure, and not just roads. We're talking sewage, we're talking stormwater drain off, we're talking fresh water, electric. All those things have to be extended as we continue to sprawl in our region. But opening up the uses and allowing for residential use in these commercial areas where that infrastructure is already in place would be a great first start.
Exactly. And something that stood out to me, one of my people that I talked to in my zoning story is someone you're familiar with, Emily Hamilton. She spoke recently as part of y'all's ongoing speaker series. She's Emily Hamilton. She's director of well, she's got a long title here, the director of Urbana D Project at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's very smart, and she had a lot of interesting stuff to say. But one of the things that stood out to me that she said was, you know, a lot of the time when we get into these robust debates at city halls that have to do with a rezoning in a neighborhood, is people will say that they're going to lose the character of their neighborhood. And she was quick to point out, you know, the character of your neighborhood is not the buildings in your neighborhood. Those are just buildings. The character is the people in your neighborhood. And so this day and age, sure, maybe low density single family zoning made sense in the 60s and 70s when, you know, everything cost a nickel. But now when you build those houses at that same size, I mean, it's like, who can afford it anymore?
Right.
And so those people that you are used to living with in your neighborhood, they're long gone and are getting replaced with either investors or mucky mucks and the like. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with like people who have money. That's fine. But she was speaking of, if you're talking about the character of a neighborhood, it's not necessarily the structures, it's the people. And I thought that was a really interesting point that she had brought up.
Absolutely. And you know, I, as we think about zoning and more residential development closer in, you know, I think the cities can target where more development takes place. So, you know, I certainly am aware of the charm and the character of our historic downtowns. And, you know, I think as the cities focus the development in certain areas, maybe that aren't developed or are underdeveloped, they can ensure that that charm and character remains. And I think the same goes, though, for our open and green space. You know, if we continue to expand our development pattern outwards, our green space, our lakes, our rivers are all going to be encroached upon. And, you know, that's part of the charm and character of Northwest Arkansas as well. It's not just our neighborhoods and our downtowns. So targeted, concentrated development will allow for both of those, I think, to remain intact and accessible to all, as we will be bringing people closer to those downtowns.
So let's move on. Let's move on to number two here. This is talking about the housing trust funds.
Yep.
You know, I've got a story coming out that explains a little bit about how this would work. But if you could, for our readers, sort of introduce them to the idea of what a housing trust fund is and what it could do if we establish one. This, by the way, was an example, an idea that the 2019 Walton Family Foundation Our Housing Future report specifically mentioned. And it seems like it could be effective if we get it going. So if you could just tell people what we're talking about here.
Sure. So a trust fund essentially is a pool of money, hence the fund name, obviously. But what this allows is for some very patient, inexpensive capital to replace market rate capital in a development project. And what's able to happen when you infuse a project with some cheap, inexpensive capital is the developer is able to offer a less than market rate unit in exchange. So, you know, with land prices where they are, with construction and development and labor prices what they are, our developers in our region are really tapped with where they can offer any level of affordability in their projects. So infusing some cheap capital into these projects would allow them to offer less than a market rate. And that would be a requirement of that funding. Typically, these funds come from government sources. In some places, they've instituted, you know, a small percentage of a sales tax is dedicated to a trust fund. Other municipalities have offered bond issuance to raise money for their trust fund. Philanthropy has played a role in providing funds to trust funds. And, you know, I think it's certainly an approach that needs to be deployed and thought about in Northwest Arkansas. Again, as we're faced with historic high building costs, labor costs, land costs, all of these factors are pushing the developer's final project away from affordability.
Well, and it's interesting because Arkansas does have a state housing trust fund. It just doesn't have any money in it.
Right.
So that's one option. You know, if the legislature ever decided that it wanted to put some more money into it, it could. It did have at one point $500,000 in it. It went to three different projects, one of which was to help build the Riverview Hope campus in Fort Smith. But usually, like you said, the source of these of revenue for these housing trust funds, it's ongoing sources of revenue, like your sales taxes, developer fees, you know, that sort of thing. And someone I spoke to with this national group, it's the Housing Trust Fund Project that's been created by the Center for Community Change. They're in Portland.
Okay.
This person, he emphasized the need for an ongoing public source of revenue for a housing trust fund. So you could have, say, if your big pockets were so inclined, like your Walmart, your Tyson's, your JB Hunt's, if they wanted to get it started, you know, sure, that could help. But the money's going to eventually run out. So you need, this is an ongoing problem. You need an ongoing source of revenue to keep it going. And you had even told me for the story that you can blow through seemingly a lot of cash for, you know, pretty quickly when it comes to housing and all the costs associated with it.
Yeah. If you're not careful, you know, $50 million can go pretty quickly when you're talking real estate and, again, historically high cost on all that makes a project happen. And to your example, I talked to a developer this morning who has some experience in Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City raised $15 million worth of bonds to put into a similar trust fund. It was just focused on the downtown of Oklahoma City. And I think he said, you know, they went through that in just a matter of months. Now, it's going to do some really good work. But, you know, a bond issuance is not that continual source of funding that a real trust fund needs, but it's certainly better than nothing.
Sure. At this point, well, it seems like better than nothing is truly that at this point in housing affordability. The last one is perhaps a little, maybe a little murkier. It could be a little more amorphous. Public-private partnerships. This can happen in a variety of ways when you start talking about what role that a city, a private entity, maybe that's a developer, maybe that's a company of some kind, maybe, and then there's also philanthropic organizations that can get in the mix. Basically, it's these different sides of the same coin coming together and deciding that there is a goal that we want to achieve with a specific project or set of projects. So what can we do? I'll give you this if you do that. That sort of arrangement, and in this instance, the common goal would be to create affordable housing in some degree, or at least make a portion of the units in a project below market rate or something like that. Jeff Webster with the Accelerate Foundation, I just got off the phone with him. He told me a lot about, they've got a whole initiative where they've got about a handful of projects that they're working on that deal with a fairly complicated, at least to the regular person like me, a way of leveraging state and federal money to you get tax credits that you can then use through a slightly complicated process that I'll clarify in my story. But the bottom line is it lessens the cost to the user if that's a tenant or a homeowner. There are other more local ways that this could be done. It could be as simple as a city chipping in for the cost to build streets or water lines and that sort of thing. So there's a whole range of ways that this can be done. If you could just kind of just tell us a little bit about how public-private partnerships could work in the region and where you see that potentially going here.
Yeah, I think, you know, typically the most natural place where I think public-private partnerships can work and the structure is, and It's my impression historically, a city or a municipality has taken a leadership role in bringing these together, you know, in that they have a piece of property or they have even a complete, a whole part of their town or municipality that needs a new, some injection of life and new energy. And so they will look at their assets within that region. And I think it typically starts with land. You know, our cities in Northwest Arkansas have varying amounts of land that they own. But, you know, if they're able to, in using land as an example, bring undeveloped land or land that needs to be redeveloped to a deal, that is a huge cost that the developer then can strip out of that deal formula that we talked about earlier. And just as trust money will, you know, strip that out, allow for some level of affordability to be infused, land and other things that can be included in a public-private partnership can be included in that same way. So as you mentioned, it can be roads, it can be street beautification, it can be in Northwest Arkansas, it's certainly a bike trail, but also, you know, underground infrastructure when it comes to water and sewage. You know, those are really capital intensive inclusions in a development, and in Northwest Arkansas, those typically fall on the developer to provide. So, you know, if the municipality is willing to pay for those, you know, it allows the developer to comfortably agree to include some less than market rate housing in that project at the back end. And, you know, I would say that I think all three of these components can work together, really, and really give the municipality a way to focus development where they want it through zoning, you know, how they want it, and who the end resident is. And, you know, these are all levers that I think our municipalities can pull to further kind of dictate who and where this activity happens in their city.
Well, to wrap up here, this kind of brings us back to, I think, the first conversation we had when I was about to embark on my novel, the story, and then decided to break it down a little bit, was that there is no one solution. There is no one silver bullet, but it's a combination of tactics. And so I'm breaking these solutions into three different stories, but you couldn't just do one. I mean, you'd have to do this, and there's other stuff too that I haven't even mentioned. But that's, yeah, I guess, part of your job, I guess, is to look at these different solutions, bring them all together, get everyone at the table, and see what can work and how it's going to work all together. It's a very collaborative approach to just an issue that's omnipresent throughout the region, and not just here, but lots of places in the country right now.
That's right. There's not a silver bullet to this. I think, you know, there's a whole menu of possibilities for not just our cities to contemplate, but our businesses, our developers, and each of them can have a 3, maybe 5% impact on housing affordability within that municipality. But really where you start to gain traction and see results is when you start to compound some of those. So you pair, you allow for residential development in a percentage of your commercially zoned area. And then, you know, the city has a fund of money that they can include in that development. And then they say, if you develop along this certain street that we want to see redeveloped, we'll pay for your infrastructure cost. You know, I think that's where you really start to see impact, and suddenly you get 3% more affordable with one measure. You get 5 on the next, and next thing you know, you're having real impact in your municipality. So
just chipping
in. And I guess I'd like to say, I mean, this is, as it pertains to my role, you know, this is still a new issue in our region. Our residents are grappling with this issue. Our businesses are grappling with this issue as they try to hire and recruit and retain employees. You know, certainly our workers are grappling with this as they're struggling to find housing that they can afford. But also, you know, our cities, our municipal staff, our political leaders, it's a new issue to them too. So I think it's incumbent on the Workforce Housing Center to be the resource and to provide best practices and provide possible solutions, to build trust with those cities, you know, that we can be a trusted resource, and provide examples of where it has happened before, because, you know, especially on the coast, but also parts not too far from Northwest Arkansas have grappled with housing affordability. And there are certainly some tried and true items that can be explored in Northwest Arkansas. And I think it's on us to bring those examples and offer solutions. And we're happy to do so and have some great municipal partners and business partners, some great developers who are all interested in this and understand the importance and the role that housing affordability plays in the continued viability of Northwest Arkansas.
Well, when you all crack the code, let me know, and we'll do a story. I can see the headline now: housing affordability solved.
Solved. Well, it may be on my children to solve that, but I think we can certainly tick away at some of those percentage points and move the needle on this.
Excellent. Well, Duke, thank you so much for spending time with us and letting our readers know what you all have going on. And for those of y'all listening, you probably already know it by now, but there is a 3-story series coming your way in the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, talking about those specific issues that we just mentioned, zoning, housing trust funds, and public-private partnerships. So give it a read, and we appreciate y'all listening.
Thanks, Stacey.